Another Monday, December 16th, we kicked off the week talking again about impeachment in the 4 o'clock hour with a representative from the Pacific Legal Foundation. 5 p.m. hour, we took a look at any impending construction on transportation in Connecticut. Will it involve only union workers? What about non-union workers? Chris Frixel was the guest in the 5 o'clock hour. He heads the Connecticut chapter of the Associated Building Contractors, a group that represents generally non-union construction workers. Legal Eagles, we're inviting in to talk about that for the next 20 minutes or so. From the Pacific Legal Foundation, attorney Daniel Ortner joins us. Dan, hi. Paul in Bridgeport, Connecticut. How are you today?
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for stepping in. I'm good, thanks. Appreciate it on the short notice here. Well, where do we stand now? I mean, I know where we stand, but technically, but in your opinion, and I try to get as many varying across both sides of the aisle opinions on this, Daniel, where do we stand right now with all the jockeying now as we approach a Senate trial?
Yeah. And I think the first thing that's worth mentioning is, you know, the founders, when they drafted the Constitution, you know, they created a mechanism of impeachment to remove a president potentially for abuses of power or of office. But they always left it open enough to the political process. The definitions being used, the procedure, it's all ultimately up to the political process, to the House and to the Senate, to work through that process. So I think what we're seeing is part of that natural process that was created by the founders. That back and forth is natural. It is inevitable. Part of the process that's been created.
And even when the founders were finding this country, Daniel, that process, these processes, as they are, as they were, they're not always clean and pretty. I mean, emotions run high, you know, temperatures run high, and there's a lot of finger pointing.
Yeah, I mean, if you look back to the Federalist Papers, you know, Alexander Hamilton wrote about impeachment, and he recognized, I think, quite clearly that impeachment, there will always be passions that will be high, and partisan passions that will be very high in the impeachment process. The founders, you know, they allowed impeachment for high crimes and misdemeanors, and that term is neither what those defending presidents want to say, which is it would have to be an actual criminal offense on the books. You know, have to have the full full requirement of the statute for a crime to be committed. Nor is it meant to be whatever Congress wants to impeach a president for whatever they disagree with. You know, there was debate about allowing impeachment for misadministration, maladministration, which would have been, you know, political disagreement, like a vote of no confidence. And the founders said, no, we don't want that. We want this to be only for abuses of power, where someone takes advantage of their office and abuses it for personal gain. That was the classic understanding of high crimes and misdemeanors.
So one of the charges, if not officially worked out in the wording here, Daniel, is that the president has done that. He's using his power ultimately as the nation's top military leader, the overall leader, the commander, the top diplomat, to try and, you know, finagle something, if you would, out of the Ukrainians. Do you think this fits that definition?
I think that if the Democrats' case was proven, if you accept it, if you believe the evidence that paints a picture of what they're claiming, that it definitely would follow the high crime and misdemeanor. If their claim is the president abused for the office of the president for the election purposes and conditioned, you know, aid to a major ally to help his reelection chances, I think that would classically fall under the definition of high crime and misdemeanor. Now, the question is whether it's been proven or not is an open question that each member of Congress has decided for themselves. But I think if the allegations are true or are proven, that it certainly would fall under the definition that the founders envisioned for high crime and misdemeanor.
Okay, Daniel, hang on. We'll be right back to you for more on that. Attorney Daniel Ortner joins us. He's with the Pacific Legal Foundation. If you want to get more information on them, pacificlegal.org. We'll be back with more with Daniel. Fascinating stuff. Traffic and weather together on the sixes here at WICC 600. And from the Pacific Legal Foundation online at pacificlegal.org is our guest, another legal to talk about the maze of impeachment here, attorney Daniel Ortner. Now, Daniel, before our break, you talked about proving that President Trump may have had a high crime or misdemeanor. In this case, from what you've seen, Is that impossible? Is it possible? Is it possible for the president to do this?
I think it certainly is possible. You know, you can prove in any court of law or any proceeding, you can always prove evidence, you know, by circumstantial evidence. You don't have to have a direct, you know, smoking gun of the president saying something. The impeachment process isn't a criminal trial either, so the standards of proof are not, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt necessarily. No one's ever defined what is the standard necessarily. It's really up to the Senate in trial, when they're going to be sitting in trial, to define what is the standard of proof for removal from office. I think, you know, some of the, if you look at the testimony that the House Judiciary Committee heard about impeachment, one of the better arguments against impeachment was by Rick Turley, who's argued basically, we don't have enough evidence yet. You need to hear more about the state of mind of the president. You need to have Mick Mulvaney testify. You need to have John Bolton testify, Giuliani testify. So I think that there is an argument that there should be more evidence, but the evidence is there. You can make a case from circumstantial evidence. That's what courts do all the time, and the Senate is, I think, entitled to do that as well.
We also heard Daniel, and once again, the guest is attorney Daniel Ortner of the Pacific Legal Foundation. We also heard in this whole process the defenders of the president saying, well, they didn't name bribery as one of the articles of impeachment. But as you point out, Daniel, bribery would be a criminal offense, and this is not a criminal process.
Right, exactly. I mean, high crime and misdemeanor was intended to be an open-ended category for abuses of power, whether or not they were criminal. If you look at the federal code at the time of the founding, there were very few federal crimes. So it can't be that whatever the president does that's impeachable has to be a federal crime on the books. It has to be an open-ended category. There was always intended to be debate. The political branches, you know, the Congress to the House and the Senate would decide ultimately whether a president abused his power or her power. That would be a matter for Congress to decide. The founders also wanted the states to have a role. That's why the Senate is the one that was going to be the one deciding the matter, because state senators were representatives of the state, essentially. So the states would have also had some role in the process. That's been lost after amendment.
Daniel, I don't know whether you saw this today, but now we're getting rumblings of this notion, and it could be far-fetched, but I wanted to bring it up to you. I don't know whether you saw, but there are rumblings now that there might be pressure on Nancy Pelosi that after a likely vote coming up on Wednesday to impeach Mr. Trump, there are going to be some people saying, well, wait a minute, if we're not going to get what we perceive as a fair trial in the Senate with witnesses, then you don't really have to necessarily forward the impeachment vote or the indictment, as it were, which is what impeachment is, to the Senate. I guess you're calling it impeachment and hold. What are your thoughts on that?
Interesting. I don't know why the Senate or the House would go through the whole process of impeaching and then not forward it to the Senate. It seems strange to me and counterproductive. If you're going to impeach, you should do it when you have enough evidence. And if you have the evidence, you shouldn't wait to pass it on. I don't understand the reasoning for that. The theory the Democrats have is a very serious one, that the president is actively trying to interfere with the upcoming election. And so if they believe that, I don't think that they should hold off on passing it along to the Senate.
Okay, so now
makes sense to me why they would do that.
Yeah, now we go to the Senate, Daniel, and now we have the fight over witnesses. We had the fight over witnesses in the House with the Democrats controlling the process there. Now it goes to the Senate. A little bit of a different process there with the impeachment managers in place with the Chief Justice John Roberts of the Supreme Court. But there will also be a fight here over witnesses, correct?
Yeah, almost certainly. As you mentioned, the Chief Justice is presiding, but the Senate gets to define its own rules of impeachment, and that's going to be driven heavily by the majority parties, the Republicans that are in charge of the Senate. And if their caucus wanted to, they could probably get whatever witnesses they wanted to testify. I'm not sure if they want to drag it out or if they just want to go and, you know, their argument is going to be what the House did is inadequate and there's not a basis for impeachment. We're just going to vote against it, against removal. So I don't know whether that strategy is going to be, but if they do try to bring witnesses, or if the Democrats try to bring witnesses, I think there will be a fight. That'll probably go to the courts. In the past, courts have been very sympathetic to Congress when they've sought witnesses and subpoenaed witnesses. typically Congress prevails against executive privilege claims, and I imagine for the most part that would be the case if these subpoenas do get tested in the courts.
Now, also pertaining... No, I was going to say, Daniel, also, did I read where it is the purvey, or it could be the purvey of the Republicans in the... them being the majority right now, that they could immediately, if they wanted to, vote to just dismiss all these charges? Is that possible? How would that work?
Well, I mean, the Constitution doesn't set out specific procedures for the Senate proceeding. So in theory, the Senate could do nothing. They could sit on the impeachment. And there's no obligation or no one... Nothing defines how they sure can or cannot act on it. And if someone would sue and say, well, you have to bring forth the articles of impeachment, I think every court would say that's a political question. It's left to the individual House of Congress to decide the procedure. They could define the procedure as they want to, really. There isn't in the Constitution a definition of what the process is like, other than that the Chief Justice presides. It's the full Senate, and conviction requires two-thirds majority. But other than those core requirements, there is no definition of what an impeachment trial looks like. Impeachment was left to Congress, ultimately, as a check on the president. It wasn't given to the judiciary, and it wasn't given to the executive. It was given to Congress, and that's why their powers are very broad in defining impeachment.
It is interesting, though, Daniel, exactly. You kind of led into my last question here. That as specific as the founders were through the years of the founding of the country with the initial Constitution and with the amendments and all that over the years, it's amazing that they left this, I don't want to say loose, but there is a lot of breathing room here that I don't think a lot of people, Daniel, understand.
Yeah, I think it's intentional. This is going to be one of the main checks that the Congress has to check the president if the president has gone out of control or overused his power. The founders weren't sure how presidents would have used their power. They'd seen the monarch do so in England in many different ways, and they weren't sure what would come, and so they wanted to give Congress open-ended power. I think they would have been surprised how rarely impeachment has been utilized in American history, that it's really only the President Trump is likely to be the third president actually impeached, the fourth that's been facing impeachment. They would be surprised by that in some ways, because this is one of the main checks that Congress had, I think, on the president. And it was given to Congress open-ended power of impeachment without many limits on it.
Attorney Daniel Ortner has been the guest. Check him out and all the excellent case studies and timely topics at pacificlegal.org. That's pacificlegal.org for the Pacific Legal Foundation. Daniel Ortner, thank you for the time, sir. We appreciate it. Have a great day.
Thanks so much, Paul. Have a great one.
Appreciate it. Thank you. And he heads the Connecticut chapter of the Associated Builders and Contractors. Those are many of the non-union folks. And Chris joins us this afternoon to talk about this. Chris, Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you?
I'm doing well, Paul. Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, I wanted to have you on because I saw you were quoted, and this is a very important issue. Chris, before we get to the specific issue here in Connecticut, tell us a little about the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Connecticut chapter that you run.
Absolutely. The Associated Builders and Contractors, the Connecticut chapter, is a statewide trade association. We're made up of more than 200 member companies that represent the construction industry, whether they be contractors, general contractors, subcontractors, or other organizations that work within the construction industry. Our association, we espouse the merit shop philosophy. That's a term that we coined. And essentially what that means is that state contracts should be awarded to the lowest responsible bidder, regardless of labor affiliation. And I want to stress regardless of labor affiliation, because really we're union agnostic, I will say. We believe that it shouldn't matter whether you are or are not a member of a union and when it comes to awarding those contracts.
And Chris, you, as many people have over the years, you object to or at least raise concerns with The laws here in Connecticut are laws that are known as project labor agreements. Talk a little about that. Explain that to our listeners.
Yeah. So I was listening to you a little bit before I came on, and state law permits the use of project labor agreements. It does not require a project labor agreement.
Mm-hmm.
What a project labor agreement is, it's really a unique contract that sets forth specific requirements not found in most construction contracts. Generally, PLAs, as they're called, they require that any contractor signing on must adhere to union work rules, recognize the union as the representative on the job, pay into union benefit funds, hire from the union halls, and also people working on those projects generally have to pay, you know, a union agency fee of some sort, whether or not they are a member of the union. And we object in the strongest of terms to the use of project labor agreements by government. First and foremost, they're discriminatory. Over approximately 85% of the construction industry in Connecticut is non-union.
Mm-hmm.
And PLAs have the effect of barring non-union contractors from bidding on those jobs. So anytime you are enacting some sort of mandate by the government that discriminates against such a huge portion of the industry, I think it is difficult to justify.
So this, in effect, Chris, you're saying, just want to make sure we're on the same page here, you're saying that PLAs are what, generally a way to lock non-union workers out of these jobs?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. They're designed in a way to accomplish that goal. And generally, these are done on a project-by-project basis. In fact, the Connecticut state law that permits their use requires that it be done on a project-by-project basis. And, you know, what happened when the governor announced his transportation program, it was sort of a blanket announcement that all of the work would be done by a project labor agreement. And really, that sort of announcement is unprecedented.
And obviously, this is the kind of thing, and the guest is Chris Frixel. He handles the Connecticut chapter of the Associated Builders and Contractors. So, Chris, you know, people hear this, and a lot of people, of course, like I do on shows like this, look at the political side of this, and they say, well, this reeks of a payback of union support, and God bless union members. They can vote for whomever they want to, but you and I both know that, in fact, their union boss came out and pretty much said it correctly, that this is a thank you for all those union votes that have put a lot of Democrat legislators in office.
Well, I won't ascribe motive to the governor for why he is or is not using a project labor agreement. What I will say is that they are discriminatory and they're wrong. And not only are they discriminatory against, and let me be specific here, we have contractors that are members that are very capable of doing this type of work, and in fact have done this type of work, and have done it very well, and won awards by some of the work that they've done, you know, in conjunction with the Department of Transportation. So these aren't fly-by-night organizations. These are big national organizations that have the track record to accomplish these very things that our state needs. And while I object to the use of PLAs because they are discriminatory and wrong, there's another consequence that I think mm-hmm. your listeners ought to know about, and that's
sure.
the increase in price. So the increase in cost to taxpayers is significant when a PLA is used. They have the effect of eliminating competition, as I mentioned. 85% of the industry in the state is non-union. So a PLA eliminates competition, which increases the cost to taxpayers. And then the mandate of you know, abiding by union work rules and that sort of thing also increases costs. Now, I want to be very clear here. My position is not one that is anti-union.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, ours is a position that everyone should have an equal opportunity to compete for these state contracts. I don't believe that all of these contracts should go to non-union companies and that union companies should be barred from participating. No, just the opposite. I'm saying level the playing field, allow all of the contractors to compete, whether they are union or not.
Chris Fixel is the guest from the Connecticut chapter of the Associated Builders and Contractors. Chris, hang on. We'll be right back to you. First, traffic and weather together on the sixes here as we come up on 5:16 on a Monday. A little bit of a storm coming in overnight. You didn't know that, huh? Well, we'll have details coming up from Bill Jackelman right after traffic first on WICC 600. 18 past 5 o'clock, Chris Fixel is the guest. Chris heads the Connecticut chapter of ABC, the Associated Builders and Contractors, talking about the dynamics here of what could be an interesting situation if the state starts this billion-dollar or several billion-dollar long-term goal of improving the transportation infrastructure in the state, on the rails, on the roads, and all that, and the use of what are called project labor agreements. Chris, tell me if I misinterpreted what you said, but before you said that, I guess, contractors that fall under your organization, they have worked with state agencies before to some success?
Oh, absolutely. And it's, you know, common. They do a lot of work with the state. Many of our contractors work with the state. And not on small projects, on large projects, on large road projects, bridges, you name it, our contractors do it all. And they've got a great track record. And I'll give you a specific example.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
We've got a contract, and this one is just so glaring that I like to bring it up. We have a contractor member that worked on renovations and repairs to the Gold Star Bridge, and they did a fantastic job. DOT was very pleased with their work. They were on time, on budget, you know, you name it. It was just a wonderful job. And part of the governor's transportation package is to renovate and repair the other side of the bridge. And should they use a project labor agreement for that, the very contractor that had already worked on it would be barred from doing that work. I don't know how that makes sense.
What is the dynamic? I mean, obviously the construction business, probably like the broadcast business, medicine, Chris. I mean, a lot of you guys know each other. The companies all know each other. You know, obviously the union shops and the non-union shops, a lot of you folks probably know each other and have traded membership from time to time. Is there, and I hate to use the word animosity, so I won't, but you know, if this comes to fruition here and we start doing all these billion-dollar-plus projects around the state, do you foresee any tension here? I mean, do your guys and gals who work for, you know, the non-union shops, do they get angry over this stuff, that they may be locked out of some of this or not? Is it kind of how the game is played?
Listen, union and non-union workers and contractors work together every single day. And the other place that we see a lot of project labor agreements are on school construction. But when a PLA is not used on a school, and one that just finished up is the intermediate school in Rocky Hill. It was a fantastic project. Again, lots of recognition for how well it went. It was not a project labor agreement, and I believe close to half of that labor was union labor. So I think it was about roughly half union, half non-union. And these guys work together. Everyone's qualified. Everyone's certified. Everyone's got their OSHA card. I mean, these guys work together on projects every single day. So there isn't animosity. Everyone knows that they have a job to do. They're able to do it. I think when it comes down to the PLA, yeah, people get upset because it's essentially being robbed of an opportunity to compete. And so when a project labor agreement, which is government mandated, again, we're talking about government mandated PLAs, the government is locking out 85% of the industry from a fair opportunity to bid on a project. And yeah, I think that does ruffle some feathers. I think if you looked at any other industry, I don't know of anywhere where that happens, but for construction, if that happened in any other industry, I think you'd see an uproar.
Well, it'd be collusion probably, but let's not go there. Legislatively, do you have any sympathetic ears in Hartford in the General Assembly? Is your problem with what could happen here on a more severe basis than it usually does, is that falling on deaf ears or not?
So there are a lot of people I've spoken to in state government that that are very much opposed to project labor agreements. There aren't, and your listeners probably are learning a thing or two, because most people don't know about them, didn't know they exist, don't really know what they do. And that's the same thing with legislators. So we're trying to educate legislators about project labor agreements, why they're bad. I mentioned cost earlier. You know, the cost is 15 to 20% increase for a project labor agreement, and the taxpayer gets nothing in return, absolutely nothing in return.
Which means that you could take that money and then even do, I mean, I'm no mathematician here, Chris, but even a dope like me knows, well, if you're spending less money, you can make that money go further by saying, hey, we can do this additional on-ramp now, or we can start this other job earlier because we're paying less for the job A here.
Yeah, absolutely. Or you know, we're trying to scrap together every penny to pay for these projects, and looking for, you know, the legislative leaders are looking for ways to raise more revenue. You don't use a project labor agreement, you don't have to raise quite as much revenue from the taxpayer. I mean, that's the long and short of it. So I think it's a no-brainer, but unfortunately, there are political factors at play, as you mentioned, and that's something that we have fought and we continue to fight.
And you do say, do you have effective voices at the Capitol? Do you guys get up there with the lobbyists or maybe the folks that are trying to explain this? As you said, are you a force to be heard up there, or is that difficult to kind of cut through all this?
We do have an effective voice at the Capitol, and I'll tell you this: what's interesting. When you speak to legislators one-on-one, they all tend to understand why PLAs are bad, and they get it. But when it comes to, you know, publicly speaking on it or casting a vote, that's when some, get a little more antsy about their position on the PLA. And that is because, you know, the trades have very effective voice in Hartford.
What do you say, final question, Chris, for you this afternoon, what do you say if somebody was listening to us right now and they may be thinking to themselves, well, hey, listen, Connecticut's a blue state, we're in the Northeast, we're a union state, we're not like those, you know, cheapo states, those non-union states like Alabama, Mississippi, Carolina, that's not how we roll up here. What would be your answer to that?
My answer would be that, again, what we are looking for is for an opportunity for all contractors, responsible contractors, the opportunity to compete for state projects. That includes union contractors and non-union contractors. But to say that we're a union state, keep in mind the perspective here, which is Connecticut is, I believe, the fourth most unionized state in the country, and it's 85% non-union in the construction industry. So keep that perspective in mind. Keep in mind all of the men and women that work for non-union contractors, those people that are trying to make a living. It's, you know, unions like to say that they represent the worker. Well, the worker is more than just those individuals that join a union. Workers work for our non-union contractors as well.
Chris Frixel heads the Connecticut chapter of the Associated Builders and Contractors. Chris, great to have you on. We'll talk to you in the future as this thing rolls down the pike. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for the opportunity, Paul.
Thanks, Chris. Bye-bye. Okay, Chris Frixel heads the Connecticut chapter of the Associated Builders and Contractors. Open phones. We'll wrap it up on the other side of traffic and weather together and news on WICC.